Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening. Who are tuned in, we give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the Radio Network and the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights. We began the UAC after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of July 2013, and we ask that you please support us and our sponsors, Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by my co-host, Dr. James Jones. On Wednesday nights, you can find him here on Sign of the Times. You can find him on Facebook as James Jones and on the World Wide Web. excuse me, y'all, at manhoodraceculture.com. Also, please support Arlie Gordon of Unity Design, and Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. Find him on Facebook as well as on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. Excuse me, y'all. And again, Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. And last but not least, we want to always remember to never forget our brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines and the family and loved ones that they represent. So please reach out to Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement, respectively, on Facebook and on the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. So tonight we're having a listen and learn session. And I think until the end of the year, because there are so many things going on in the community, we're bringing Sign of the Times to where the people are. We're going to be traveling. I think I'm going to turn Tuesdays into listen and learn session days here on Sign of the Time. One, I've had some pretty interesting conversations over the past week or so with comrades who are helping to put the UAC together, willing to donate their time and energy and resources and assets to the table to make sure that this foundation that we're building is going to be solid and based on uncompromised principles. And so things are picking up in the community, everybody. And one of the things that we know that we need to focus on is our political education, learning from our history, learning from the mistakes that have been made, and the successes that were able to be accomplished. There's a methodology to everything, or a code, as Neely Fuller often teaches. So we're trying to code our future. We're not willing to invest a lot of energy into name-calling, defaming, and things like that that often happen with revolutionary-minded, especially melanated-based organizations. Like, we're not interested in making anyone else feel bad for their behavior. Like, we're trying to build on the assets that we all bring to the table and that we're all willing to contribute. And that's going to be what's going to make this foundation solid, and it's going to be what makes our organization different and unique. Nothing against anybody else's approach to their problem solving, but that's just not how we're going to move as an organization. We don't think that it's going to be energy well invested. So Tuesday nights are going to turn into PE Tuesdays. And tonight we're going to have a listen and learn on Che Guevara and how his uncompromised principles were the things that make him so relevant even today. So there's a lesson to be learned in that for all of us, no matter what our skin color is, no matter what our approach or ideology to problem solving and addressing issues in our community. This is something that we all can learn from. So pen and piece of paper, everybody. You know, that's the teacher in me. I always say that during our listen and learn sessions because it's important. I mean, you'd be surprised sometimes you hear things that you didn't expect to hear. So please get a pen and piece of paper out. I know there's going to be something that's going to resonate with you. We're going to continue this dialogue all of this week, talking about uncompromised principles, talking about some of the things that we need to address differently, like racism and oppression in our community, so that it's going to be energy well used and not energy that will disappear in the abyss and we never get a return on our investment, if you will. So feel free to reach out to me directly. I take texts as well, so this is my direct line, everybody. So 513-913-2691, 513-913-2691. Let us know if there's some listen and learn sessions that you would recommend, or even if you want to come on and do a live listen and learn and a PE session, I'd welcome that too. So just let me know. We're here for you because we know that we've got a lot of work to do. And we can't do it by ourselves. So enjoy tonight's documentary on Che Guevara, and we'll continue to have this dialogue the rest of this week. So this is Queen Ty here signing off for the evening. Hit one if you want me to open up your mic, but enjoy this session, everybody. 513-913-2691 is how you can reach me. Queen Ty here on Facebook as well as of course, Newtown Radio Network and Sign of the Times. All right, we'll see you on the other side, everybody. Salute.
Presencia comandante está viva, está lo sana en la vida.
I feel something in life, not just a great interior force, but also the power to transmit it to others. It's a fatalistic sense of my mission which frees me from all fears. Ernesto Che Guevara.
Firme y clara, comandante Che Guevara, del ejemplo de tu vida. Comandante, comandante, comandante Che Guevara, aquí seguimos queriendo la aurora profunda y clara de tu presencia gigante.
Ernesto Guevara de la Serna was born in Rosario, Argentina, on the 14th of May 1928, a day in which Ernesto would never celebrate his birthday. There's a different date on his birth certificate, the 14th of June. With a white lie, his parents had decided to hide a pregnancy out of wedlock. His mother, Celia de la Serna, was the heiress of a family of landowners related to the aristocracy of Spain and the New World. A rebellious girl with aristocratic grace, in Buenos Aires, she was one of the first women to wear short hair. She drove a car, signed checks, and crossed her legs in public. His father, Ernesto Guevara Link, was a pleasant and good-looking young man. He was mercurial, like his great-grandfather, who took part in the gold rush in California. He was exuberant and very imaginative. The Guevara family were different. They were chaotic, generous, and intellectually restless. Ernestito, little Ernest as he was nicknamed, spent the first 2 years of his life in an immense garden, until one day in the spring of 1930, a day which was to have a significant effect on his future personality. On the 2nd of May, 1930, after bathing in the frozen water of a swimming pool, he suffered his first asthma attack. It was the beginning of a problem which over the years would force him to forge an iron-like determination. In 1943, the De la Sernas moved to Buenos Aires, and Ernesto started high school. World War II was still raging in Europe, and his parents supported the solidarity movements for the fight against Nazism. But Ernesto had yet to become involved in politics. I didn't get involved in community activities during my adolescence, and I didn't take part in political or student campaigns in Argentina. Deeply affected by the death of his grandmother in 1947, Ernesto decided to study medicine at the University of Buenos Aires. Exempt from military service because of his asthma, Ernesto, the student, played tennis and golf but excelled at rugby. He played for Estudiantes of Córdoba with the nickname Fuser, an abbreviation of the Furious de la Serna. With his natural enthusiasm, despite his asthma, he became the leader of the team. He also found a magazine called Tackle, and his byline was Chanco, pig. He liked to boast that he rarely washed himself, and that he once wore the same rugby shirt for 25 weeks in a row. He took up a position as a nurse on a tanker, worked in the communal slaughterhouses, and then at the university library. With a companion, he invented an insecticide, which he hoped to commercialize. At the same time, he took up an interest in politics. It was the natural result of his readings and perhaps because of the turbulent times he was living in. The succession of coup d'etat, the rise of Perón in Argentina, and so on. So Ernesto started frequenting a group of Marxists at university, but never joined the party. University disappointed him. He was looking for a vocation, while they were talking about a career. During the university vacation, he decided to visit his friend, Alberto Granado, on the Sierra, to the north of Córdoba. A medicine graduate, Alberto worked in a leper hospital in San Francisco de Chanar. Ernesto fixed an engine to his bicycle to make the 850-kilometer journey. The only things he took with him were a spare tire, a few clothes, and a book. Cuba, March 2nd, 1952. Military coup d'etat. Backed by the United States, Colonel Fulgencio Batista took power. The island was nicknamed the Brothel of America. Gambling, prostitution, and cabaret. Cuba became a playground for rich Americans. Foreigners controlled the entire economy of the island. Strongly Americanized, the capital city, Havana, became relatively prosperous. But huge shanty towns surrounded the capital. It was a completely different reality. 50% of the population was illiterate, and the people in the countryside lived in the most absolute conditions of hardship and poverty. Pillaging, corruption, Batista was an unscrupulous dictator. A man of the United States, he was the guarantor of their interests on the island. At the end of his holidays, Ernesto returned to Buenos Aires. He crossed the bush and often shared the life of the gauchos. Ernesto was 23 years old and had almost finished his studies in medicine. Hungry for discoveries and adventures, Ernesto decided to undertake another initiatory journey across the whole of Latin America with his friend Alberto Granado. On December 29, 1952, they got onto an old Norton motorbike nicknamed La Poderosa, the Mighty. As they were leaving, his father dropped his revolver amongst his son's equipment. Dr. Granado and his assistant, Guevara, passed through Chile as they crossed the Andes. The Norton motorbike was already breaking down. They hitchhiked as far as Valparaíso, where they secretly boarded a freighter. They went up towards Bolivia and visited the enormous mines exploited by the United States, which revealed to them the enormous socio-political injustice in the treatment of South American workers. Their journey continued towards Peru, Lake Titicaca, Cusco, Machu Picchu, and then in the direction of the Amazon, where they arrived at the San Pablo Leper Hospital. That aimless journey around our America changed me more than I thought. After traveling together for 7 months, the two friends separated. Ernesto had just $1 in his pocket and promised his mother, Celia, that he would return home to finish his studies. The freighter that took him back to Buenos Aires was forced to dock in Miami. While he waited for the ship to be repaired, Ernesto Guevara had to survive for 20 days with just $1. He completed his doctorate in record time. But Dr. Guevara didn't care a bit about this prestigious title. He couldn't wait to set off again. Ernesto arrived in Guatemala, where something new was happening. President Jacopo Arbenz, a progressivist military man, had promised a vast program of reforms. The most important idea was that of bringing to an end the existence of larger states and nationalizing the properties of United Fruit, a very powerful U.S. company. With the support of the Eisenhower administration, the local oligarchy was against the idea. Along the way, I had the chance to see the United Fruit properties. Once again, I was convinced of how terrible these capitalist octopuses are. I will improve myself and acquire what I need to become an authentic revolutionary. In December 1953, Ernesto settled in the capital and met several Cuban exiles who had taken refuge in Guatemala after a failed insurrection attempt led by Fidel Castro against the Batista regime. Led by a young Cuban lawyer, Fidel Castro, they tried to capture the Moncada barracks. The armed assault resulted in carnage, and their leader was captured and condemned to 15 years in prison. In remembrance of the Moncada assault, the group decided to call themselves the 26th of July Movement. June 15, 1954. The Eisenhower administration gave the go-ahead to Operation Success. This was a CIA plan which financed the opposition to the government and trained a paramilitary force to invade the country. The situation precipitated in the space of a few weeks. Jacopo Arbenz resigned and left the country in the hands of a new military government loyal to American strategic interests. These were dangerous times for supporters of Arbenz's progressivist government. Ernesto decided to move to Mexico, where his life reached a turning point. While Cuba was rocked by the student protests against Batista's corrupt regime, Fidel Castro was unexpectedly freed from prison and immediately joined his companions in Mexico. July 7th, 1955, Mexico City. Meeting Cuban revolutionary Fidel Castro was a political event. An intelligent boy, he's very sure of himself and is extraordinarily courageous. I think there's mutual respect between us. When Ernesto met the volcanic Fidel, it was love at first sight. Castro was looking for a doctor to join the group of revolutionaries that would land in Cuba to overthrow dictator Batista. Guevara didn't think twice. He will carry out the revolution. We're in perfect harmony. Only for someone like him would I give all of myself. At that time, Ernesto was financially dependent on Hilda Gadea, a woman who belonged to the left wing of the Peruvian party, which was there in exile. Just after he met Fidel Castro, Hilda told Che that she was pregnant. He wrote in his diary that he would marry to keep her dignity. From the 15th of February 1956, I'm a father. My communist soul expands in an excessive manner. The baby girl came out just like Mao Zedong. At the moment she weighs less than Mao, but she will grow. At last, Castro found a boat to reach Cuba. The Granma was an old cabin cruiser. On board, there were 79 Cuban revolutionaries and three foreigners. Globe-trotting Argentine doctor Ernesto Guevara, Dominican Ramon Mejias, also known as Pichirillo, and Italian Gino Donè, who was fleeing post-war unemployment. Everything was ready for departure. December 2nd, 1956. It wasn't a landing. It was a shipwreck. The 82 people who landed on the Cuban coastline were decimated by the initial skirmishes with the army. The dozen that survived hid in the Sierra Maestra, a massif 130 kilometers long and 50 kilometers wide. Up against a 4,000-strong modern army, the guerrillas established relationships with the campesinos, peasants, which progressively boosted their ranks. It was our baptism of fire, the beginning of the formation of what was to become the rebel army. Right during the shootout, I found myself in front of a rucksack full of medicine and a crate of ammunition. The weight stopped me from taking both. I took the crate of ammunition and left the rucksack. In battle, Ernesto Che Guevara found his missing part. He discovered he was unafraid of dying and played a fundamental role in the development and survival of the rebel army. One day, a spy among the rebel army was discovered. It was one of the peasants who had voluntarily joined up. The traitor was unmasked and condemned to death, but nobody was prepared to carry out the execution. Che volunteered himself and wrote about it in his diary, describing the size of the wound caused by the bullet and how the bullet entered and exited the man's brain. He wrote about how calmly he slept that night, without asthma attacks. Without any advance notice, Fidel named Ernesto commander. It was the highest military position in the rebel army. There's a bit of vanity inside every one of us. This appointment made me feel the most important man on earth. From that moment, Ernesto was known by everybody as Commander Guevara. With his men, Che installed a radio transmitter and the typography of a newspaper to spread the word about the actions and conquests of the rebel army. Radio Rebelde brought the voice of the revolutionaries to the whole island. The message was simple: freedom or death.
Radio Rebelde, transmitiendo desde las montañas de Oriente, territorio libre de Cuba.
Commander Guevara set up an out-and-out arms factory, which produced bullets, grenades, and even a homemade M26 weapon, which was thrown from a catapult constructed with the springs of an underwater fishing gun. Inside the liberated zone, the rebels paid for their purchases with coupons signed by Ernesto Guevara. Che was a visionary, a mystic, while Fidel was a pragmatist, a realist, and an obstinate politician. Che had no political or diplomatic ability. He didn't mince his words and made enemies in next to no time. If he didn't like someone, he told them directly. He was combative, ideological, and really did think he could change the world. In the summer, Fidel Castro's guerrillas left the mountains and took their fight to the plains. Commander Guevara's column took control of Latvias province. The island was now split in two. It's very, very difficult to advance. Our comrades' physical conditions are worsening, and eating now and then certainly doesn't help to improve the miserable situation we find ourselves in. It was in this region, considered a starting point of the revolution, where he met his future companion, Aleida Mash. She was a young and very beautiful woman who joined the secret 26th of July movement in Santa Clara. Aleida arrived at the battleground, where she found Che Guevara, and spent several days there. They became lovers in the mountains. By Christmas, the war was practically won, Only the city of Santa Clara, the cornerstone of Batista's defense, was still to be taken. December 29, 1958. The battle commenced. Guevara's column besieged the city. The regular army drew up thousands of soldiers and an armored train, which the dictator considered his secret weapon against the revolution. Machine guns spat death from the turrets. Suicide squads doused them with petrol. The armor plating became an oven for the soldiers, who decided to surrender. They all surrendered in just a few hours, with their 22 wagons, cannons, machine guns, and fantastic ammunition supplies. At dawn on January 1st, 1959, Fulgencio Batista fled to the Dominican Republic, taking with him a veritable fortune. He left the country in the hands of a military junta which uselessly proposed an armistice to Fidel Castro. The rebel army was already marching towards Havana. January 3rd, 1959. Commander Guevara's column entered the capital. Popular enthusiasm was overwhelming. Several days later, Fidel Castro made his own triumphant entry into Havana. The revolution of the Barbudos, as everyone called the Sierra rebels, had won. Che was nominated military governor of the Cabana fortress which faced Havana. It was also where the revolutionary courts were set up. It was here that Batista's executioners were put on trial. With his consent, Che became supreme prosecutor. Hundreds were summarily executed after the trial. Ernesto Che Guevara was just 30 years old and already a legend. The foreigner, the Argentine as they called him in Cuba, would soon receive Cuban citizenship thanks to a clause in the new constitution written especially for him.
Primero de mayo, principios que fueron, lucha de obrero, que se rebeló.
Together with a few trusted companions, Guevara worked on the creation of a secret service for the security of the state. On Fidel's orders, he prepared the agrarian reform promised to the peasants by the revolutionaries. He was nominated Minister for Industry and found himself leading the ambitious Cuba industrialization program. To set up an industrialization process, Cuba must first recuperate its natural resources, which were given to foreign consortiums by the Batista dictatorship. And we must be prepared for the reaction of those who today control 75% of our trade and market. Guevara had clear ideas on the path to take to assert the revolutionary ideals. Redistribution of land to the peasants. The end of the sugar monoculture. Nationalization of foreign enterprises. Central planning of the economy.
Vivía oprimido y sufriendo sin poder decir verdades.
The social programs included a massive literacy campaign. Trains transported thousands of volunteers from all over the island who wanted to learn to read and write. In 1959, 40% of Cubans were illiterate. It was a spectacular march which was supported by UNESCO. Disarmed to avoid any form of criticism, the allegorical army danced and sang to the rhythm of the slogans which demanded free education for all, which would also guarantee national unity for a long time to come. Guevara was also appointed president of the National Bank of Cuba. His capacity for work became legendary. From time to time, he wrote to his parents. Dear folks, it's 6:30 in the morning, and I'm taking a break. It's not the start of the day, but the end. On the other hand, we are the future and we know it. We build with joy, even though we've forgotten our nearest and dearest. After divorcing Hilda Gadea, Che married his new companion, Elida Marsh, who would give him 4 more children. June 12, 1959. Che left for the first of his long trips as worldwide ambassador of the Cuban Revolution. He traveled extensively in search of new diplomatic and, above all, commercial relationships. Strict with himself, he decided to leave Elida at home, but regretted it and wrote to his mother from India. I have to talk about political and economic problems. I take part in receptions where I even have to wear a dinner suit. On top of all this, I'm without Elida, who I couldn't bring because of the many mental complexes I suffer from. In the meantime, in Cuba, the nationalization of foreign enterprises and agrarian expropriations continued to develop. The United States became increasingly worried about the progress of relations between Cuba and the Soviet Union. Differences with Washington became increasingly clear. It was the most serious attack ever on Cuban soil. On March 4th, a French freighter laden with ammunition exploded. The weapons were bought from Belgium. 80 people lost their lives. Fidel Castro accused the United States, which immediately denied responsibility. 2 weeks later, Eisenhower approved a secret plan to overthrow Castro. There was widespread speculation about the United States' hostility towards the harsh methods used by the Cuban Revolution. These images fueled the Cuban anti-Americanism, and Fidel took advantage of the situation to justify his policy. Cuba assumed the image of the victim, and gradually, in the name of national security, the revolution changed face. The Americans radically reduced sugar imports, which provoked a reconciliation with the Soviets. On October 19th, the United States imposed a trade embargo against the island. 3 days after the announcement of the American embargo, Che Guevara left for his first journey to the communist bloc countries. He had to assure the sale of Cuban sugar and to obtain credit for the construction of new factories. In China, he was welcomed with full honors. On the airport runway, Vice President Zhou Enlai received him. But it was in the Soviet Union that Guevara stopped the longest. He visited Moscow, Leningrad, and even found time for some sightseeing. He met an infinite number of people, soldiers and workers. He watched a performance at the Bolshoi Theater. He met Nikita Khrushchev. He was even invited onto the Presidium balcony in Red Square to admire the military parade on November 7th. In the meantime, the atmosphere in Cuba had changed. The state now controlled banks, education, transport, industry, and agriculture. The humanist face of the revolution had become tougher, and well-off Cubans left the country. The anti-Castrist front widened. Opponents of the revolution reorganized. Old soldiers of the Batista dictatorship, landowners and rebel officials of the army. In all, there were 3,000 men. Officially, they were all United States agents. On April 15th, the CIA bombed the airports in Havana and Santiago. 7 people died. The already meager Cuban aviation lost 5 aircraft. It was a time of plots to assassinate Castro, attempts to subvert the new Cuban power with the support of the CIA, and the disastrous expedition to the Bay of Pigs, endorsed by the new president, John F. Kennedy. In Havana, heavy artillery was positioned along the Malecon seafront, while 35,000 people were accused of hostile acts against the regime and were detained by the police and revolutionary defense committees. The CIA was hoping that an anti-Castrist insurrection would favor invasion. It didn't turn out that way. August 1961. At Punta del Este in Uruguay, a conference of the Organization of American States was held, and Guevara did everything he could to be noticed. He sent a message to President Kennedy via American journalists. Thanks for Playa Girón, the Bay of Pigs. Before the invasion, the revolution was shaky. Now it's stronger than ever. The United States delegation, head's speech, was vague and without substance. Guevara had brought the Cold War to Uruguay and attacked the United States. The reference to plots financed by the United States was crystal clear, and the consequences were just around the corner. America stopped all aid to countries maintaining relations with Cuba, and several months later, the Organization of American States expelled Cuba. In the meantime, another of Guevara's battles began. He promoted the creation of a new socialist man role model. He called it the new man, an unselfish and solid figure prepared to give everything for the community. As a demonstration, he launched the volunteer work experiment.
El trabajo voluntario es una escuela creadora de conciencia. Es el esfuerzo realizado en la sociedad y para la sociedad como aporte individual y colectivo y va formando esa alta conciencia que nos permite acelerar el proceso del tránsito hacia el comunismo.
After the Bay of Pigs, Castro was convinced that the United States was preparing to invade Cuba, and he asked Moscow for military protection. Whose idea was it to install nuclear missiles on the island? Castro's or Khrushchev's? The Cubans said it was the Soviets. and vice versa. Che began to realize that the Soviet Union was a country full of defects, and he felt increasingly frustrated in dealing with them. He wanted to build a steelworks in Cuba. He wanted the Soviets to help Cuba develop the spirit of socialist egalitarianism and solidarity among comrades. He wanted to be supported in his idea of creating the new man, the true communist, and he wanted Cuba to be free at last. He failed to accomplish any of these things, and a conflict arose between Che Guevara and the orthodox Cuban communists that backed Moscow. October 1962. In Cuban waters, there was the threat of another world war. It was the missile crisis, and the Castro Revolution realized it was a pawn in a very big chess game. For Guevara, it was the sign that something had changed. His initial enthusiasm for the Soviet model had faded. His economic objectives never took off. With his idea of a new socialist man, he was considered utopian. He no longer felt indispensable in Cuba. Guevara felt that the need to return to the battlefield of the worldwide revolution was stronger than ever. On December 11, 1964, the Cuban revolutionary was in New York, representing Cuba at the United Nations General Assembly. Cuban exiles welcomed him with extremely violent protests. Guevara had arrived to announce another campaign of revolutionary battles, and the tenor of his words left no doubts.
Sacrificarse hasta la muerte en los campos de batalla de todos los continentes del mundo.
February 25, 1965. In Algiers, he spoke about the Third World. He made a very harsh speech. He accused socialist superpowers, China and the Soviet Union, of applying principles of capitalism in commercial dealings with developing countries. It was his last public speech.
Vive l'armée nationale populaire. Venceremos.
The development of countries that are at the beginning of their path to liberation must be paid for by socialist countries. Socialism cannot exist without a new fraternal attitude towards humanity. Che was no longer under any illusions. His great challenge was underway. Fiercely determined, he set out to show the world what proletarian internationalism really was. In Cuba, his life seemed to continue as before. Few knew that he was about to leave, that he might never return. In the meantime, Fidel Castro adopted a cautious stance. In public, he talked of pacific coexistence, while in private, he said if Che could plant the revolutionary flag somewhere else, he'd leave him free to act. Guevara left several farewell letters. One of these was for Fidel.
Tierras del mundo reclaman el concurso de mis modestos esfuerzos. Aquí dejo lo más puro de mis esperanzas de constructor.
I leave here the purest of my hopes as a builder and the dearest of those I hold dear. I carry to new battlefronts the faith that you taught me.
En los nuevos campos de batalla llevaré la fe que me inculcaste, el espíritu revolucionario de mi pueblo, la sensación de cumplir con el más sagrado de los deberes, luchar contra el imperialismo donde quiera que esté. Esto reconforta y cura con creces cualquier desgarradura.
April 1st, 1965. Ernesto Che Guevara left for Africa. 3 weeks later, he reached the Congolese shores of Lake Tanganyika, where he met an unexpected reality. No one has the slightest idea of what a firearm is. They shoot while playing with their weapons or because of carelessness. Disagreements within the anti-government movement stopped Guevara from organizing military action. Weeks, months of inertia followed. After 7 months of almost no fighting and the frustrating impossibility of training the local soldiers, Guevara made a bitter and self-critical analysis. I learned a lot in Congo, and I left with more faith than ever in the guerrilla fight. But we failed. November 22nd, 1965. Che left Congo and secretly returned to Cuba, but his mission to liberate oppressed populations was not over. He soon decided on Bolivia. A military junta had just come to power. Clashes, protests, and demonstrations were inflaming the country. The CIA thought he was in hospital in the Soviet Union. With the help of the Cuban secret services, Guevara transformed himself into a middle-class 40-year-old. He wore thick-lensed glasses, he was half-bald, and his eyebrows were thicker. To seem shorter, he took out the insides of the heels on his shoes. With roughly 50 men, he tried to set up a training base. On November 7th, the men built a tunnel to hide provisions and materials. Instead of supporting the guerrillas, the Bolivian Communist Party launched a dissuasion campaign. The situation is not good. But a new stage of testing begins for the guerrillas, and it will do us good if we overcome it. Months passed in pursuit of and escaping from the army, which seemed to be everywhere. The comrades' losses became increasingly higher. Che was ill. He could hardly walk. He had lost about a third of his body weight. He was emaciated and famished. He was different, no longer as attentive and cautious as he used to be. August 1967. Increasingly alone, the guerrillas tried to flee northwards. They reached the mountains and apparent safety. September 1967. The town of Valle Grande, in the heart of Bolivia, became the base for the Bolivian army's anti-guerrilla operations. Commander Guevara moved into the open, with few precautions and apparently without a plan. His diary entries at this time are addressed to Aleida. They seem written by a man aware that he's marching towards his own end. The best bullet of this pistol, which has always accompanied me, the indelible memory of the children that one day you and I conceived, and the fragment of life that remains of me, I give this to the revolution. Nothing which is capable of uniting us can ever have a greater power. September 26th. The guerrillas arrived in the village of La Higuera, a piece of land between two mountains, where there were only women and children. The peasants had fled after being warned of the army's arrival. The guerrillas were ambushed by the army. Three comrades were killed and two wounded. On October 7th, Commander Guevara was optimistic and wrote what was to be the last page in his diary. It has now been 11 months since the start of the guerrilla movement. It's a day without problems, bucolic. There were 17 of them left. That night, Che picked up a Chilean radio station. There were 1,800 Bolivian soldiers looking for them in the mountains. October 8, 1967. Surrounded by two companies of Bolivian rangers in the Churro Gorge, Che Guevara was shot in the leg and captured. A bullet had destroyed the cylinder of his rifle, and Che couldn't use his weapon. With arms extended, leaning on two soldiers, the most wanted man in the world was led to the village of La Higuera, where he was imprisoned in a school. Che Guevara slept on the floor of the school during the night between the 8th and the 9th of October. His hands and feet were bound. The bodies of his friends lay next to him. October 9th. At 12:30, a radio message from the Bolivian High Command in La Paz read, "Proceed with the elimination of Señor Guevara." The order was signed by the president of the Bolivian military government. A meeting took place to decide what to do with Che Guevara, and it was decided he must die. The order was transmitted in code to CIA agent Felice Rodriguez. The agent entered the room and said simply to Guevara, "Commander, I'm sorry." Sergeant Mario Terranzi volunteered to carry out the order. It was 1:10 in the afternoon. With a semi-automatic pistol, he fired at Che's arms, legs, then chest. It was October 9th, 1967. Ernesto Che Guevara was 39 years old. The bullet-riddled body was fastened to a helicopter skid for its final journey. When it arrived at Valle Grande, the eyes were still wide open. The soldiers called a photographer to immortalize the moment. The first journalists and onlookers arrived. Before long, a veritable procession of people had begun. Some of them secretly cut off small locks of his hair as good luck charms. News of his death broke in Cuba. The radio reported that Commander Guevara had died from battle wounds. Fidel Castro was doubtful. He didn't want to believe it. October 15th. Fidel received the photos of Che Guevara's corpse. Now he had proof. The reports were true. In an emotion-filled voice, he addressed the Cuban people and passionately remembered his fallen comrade.
Un modelo de hombre que no pertenece a este tiempo. Un modelo de hombre que pertenece a los tiempos futuros. De corazón digo que ese modelo, sin una sola mancha en su conducta, sin una sola mancha en su actitud, sin una sola mancha en su actuación, ese modelo es el Che. queremos saber cómo deseamos que sean nuestros hijos, debemos decir con todo el corazón de vehementes revolucionarios: queremos que sean como el Che.
Inmortal, a nuestro guerrillero heroico.
Thirty years after his death in Bolivia, the remains of Che Guevara were returned to Cuba. With the regime rhetoric that he so disliked, the Cuban population paid homage to him. The romantic image of the revolutionary, his face and his words, have become part of popular imagination. Legend has consigned him to history as forever young, forever a rebel. Ernesto Che Guevara conquered death. He knew he would. He knew it the day he said to the soldier who came to kill him, "I know you've come here to kill me. Shoot. You're only killing a man."
Ahora está más anónima esta América de color, sombría, taciturna, que canta en todo el continente con una misma tristeza y desengaño. Ahora esta masa es la que empieza a entrar definitivamente en su propia historia. La empieza a escribir con su sangre, la empieza a sufrir y a morir. Porque ahora por los campos y las montañas de América, por las faldas de sus sierras, por sus llanuras y sus selvas, entre la soledad o el tráfico de las ciudades, en las costas de los grandes océanos y ríos, se empieza a estremecer este mundo lleno de corazones con los puños calientes de deseo de morir por lo suyo, de conquistar sus derechos, casi 500 años burlados por unos y por otros. Porque esta gran humanidad ha dicho basta y ha echado a andar, y su marcha de gigantes ya no se detendrá hasta conquistar la verdadera independencia, por la que ya han muerto más de una vez inútilmente. Ahora, en todo caso, los que mueran, morirán como los de Cuba, los de Playa Girón. Morirán por su única, verdadera, irrenunciable independencia.
Comandante Che Guevara.
When you have a government that operates without limits, which proclaims the right to arrest, torture, and kill anyone, anywhere, with no warrants, no trial, no due process, when you have a government that militarizes the police and grants the armed forces the power to operate with impunity, within your own borders and beyond, a government that views you, the people, as the enemy, and treats you as such, when you have a government that lies to take you into wars of aggression, toppling country after country, killing countless innocent civilians, sending your sons and daughters, your fathers and brothers home in flag-draped coffins, were disfigured and broken in mind and body, their lives destroyed in wars that serve only to line the pockets of an unelected cartel of bankers and corporations. When you have all of this right in front of you, so blatant, so clear, with president after president towing the line of the same agenda, you shouldn't have to be convinced that both parties in this political puppet show are owned and operated by the same interest. And you shouldn't have to be convinced that these overrated corporate popularity contests that some call elections are distractions that achieve nothing. And if you see where this is headed, you shouldn't have to be convinced that the system that you're living under must be brought to a halt. These are obvious conclusions for those who've been paying attention, so we won't try to convince you here. This video focuses solely on how to bring that system to a halt. Think of it as an instruction manual for a revolution. There are those who will be taken aback when you start using the word revolution. Revolution, the act of revolting and overturning the current power structure, is an extreme measure, one that should be handled with extreme caution, and in most cases, they should be avoided. Revolutions are dangerous in every sense of the word, and it is difficult, if not impossible, to predict their outcome. But there are times when allowing those in control to stay in control is even more dangerous. Right now, the question you need to ask yourself is this: are we at that point yet? Can the current system be reformed? Revolutions begin with a no, and they end with a yes. Revolutions begin when you say no to those who claim to have power over you. And revolutions end when you accept a new status quo, a new normal, whether that new normal is an improvement or not. The causes of revolution are numerous in form, but there is one common root, and that's discontent. Discontent is the emotion that builds and builds under the surface. It is a storm which brews in the mind of the people, just waiting to be unleashed. The trouble is that it's much easier to unleash that storm than it is to get people in agreement as to what should come next. It's not easy to get people to see eye to eye regarding what needs to happen after the current system falls. So this is usually put off, or avoided altogether. And that's a serious mistake. Without clear objectives, chaos usually sets in soon after the old regime falls. And then, in the power vacuum that's created, a tyrant rises to bring order. As a result, the systems that follow revolutions are often just as totalitarian or more totalitarian than those that they replace. It should therefore be abundantly obvious that discontent is not a sufficient driving force for a revolution. That is, if your goal is to actually leave a better world for your children and grandchildren. In order for an upheaval to have positive results, it must be driven by a clear and realistic vision. A vision that accounts for the world and humans the way that they actually are right now, not the way that we wish they would be, or that we hope that they might be. And it must differentiate between that which can and cannot be changed in the short term. There is nothing more dangerous than armed men with utopian dreams. So, let's be realistic, shall we? We the people are divided. We have divided ourselves into classes and subclasses, liberals and conservatives, libertarians, anarchists, socialists, anarcho-socialists, minarchists, state-based free market capitalists, anarcho-capitalists, resource-based economy advocates, and more. There is absolutely no chance that any one of you is going to convince all the others that your way is the right way. Unless, of course, one of you rises to political power in the fray and enforces your beliefs by the barrel of a gun. This is the way it usually happens throughout history, and this is what we must avoid repeating. The movement is only successful if it starts with an idea that is strong enough to take root in the mind of the population and inspires and motivates people to spread it. It is possible for a diverse and divided people to form a coalition in times of great need and unify around an idea, but it only works if that idea meets the following three requirements. 1. It must articulate a clear and defined common interest which allow the people to work together. The necessity for unification, even if that unification is temporary, needs to be evident to all stakeholders, and it must be accompanied by a sense of urgency which impels people to reach out to others in their community and spread the idea. 2. A clear vision of what you're working towards. What are you going to replace the current system with? Ironing out the fine details isn't actually productive. What's needed is a broad and abstract vision based on principles. In human societies, extreme and abrupt changes are usually destructive. All efforts must be made to retain social stability. This means steering clear of any sort of utopian fantasies. The time to rewire humanity is not during a period of crisis. Historically, such attempts usually end in tragedy. 3. A plan of action and a clear understanding of the rules of engagement. We'll refer to these three elements collectively as the conscious revolution paradigm. You don't have to get mystical about it. It just means think before you act. let's start with the common interest. Establishing the common interest is easy if you're informed. And if the people around you aren't informed, then your job is clear. Inform them. Whether you consider yourself a liberal or conservative or none of the above, the bankers and the corporations which hold the puppet strings of the state have placed us all on a path that leads to complete and total destruction. Our common interest is the world that we're leaving our children. The clear vision of what we're working towards is much harder. Again, there's nothing more dangerous than armed men with utopian dreams. And there's no greater symptom of utopianism than the illusion that we can convince the entire world to accept one monolithic belief system. Yet, at the same time, all great movements are driven by an idea. They're driven by a vision. How do we resolve this apparent contradiction? How do we find a common vision without falling for the naive fantasy that we can unify all worldviews? The answer is actually pretty simple. And that's a good thing, because only very simple ideas can be transmitted from person to person without breaking down. Our vision must start with the foundational understanding that there's not one single right way for humans to live on this planet, and that it is unacceptable to force others into any system without their consent, or to use violence or coercion to compel them to obey a set of rules that they never agreed to. That should just be common sense, but it's really not for most people. Most people like to use government thugs to enforce their good intentions. They just don't like it when it comes home to roost and the gun is pointed in their face. When the current system falls, there's going to be no way to reconstitute it in its old shape and size without violence and coercion, and even that probably wouldn't work. Therefore, the only real ethical option is to accept that Humpty Dumpty isn't going to be put back together again. When it's time to rebuild, we don't need to figure out one system that everybody can fit under. Rather, we need to figure out an approach which facilitates multiple systems side by side. What would this look like? Well, imagine a network of small, voluntarily formed communities bound together in loose federations that cooperate for mutual defense and trade as needed, with decision-making taking place at the local level. It's a simple concept, one that's been applied many times throughout history. The most striking example, however, is the Iroquois Federation, which unified six tribes, each with their own cultures and traditions. The Iroquois Federation existed before the arrival of Columbus and lasted until 1779 when they were conquered militarily by the U.S. Many historians believe that the Iroquois Federation served as the original inspiration for the United States. The most striking difference being that the Iroquois Federation never had a central government. No one at the top had the power to force the member tribes to do anything whatsoever. And yet, this system worked, and it worked well for a very long time. So clearly this is not a utopian fantasy. It's a viable option, and it's the only option that can be enacted on a voluntary basis. The final element of the conscious revolution paradigm is the plan of action, the strategy and tactics, the short-term and long-term goals, and the structure of the movement. So let's start with the top-level strategy, move towards tactics. Some think of revolution in terms of bullets and bombs, but this is a misconception. Revolutions are about pulling the pillars of power out from underneath the state, one by one, until it falls. The state leans on three primary pillars of power. One, the control of the group mind, ideas, and beliefs. Two, the control of money, finance, and thereby human activity. And three, the monopoly on violence and the use of intimidation to extract obedience by fear. There are three stages of revolution, and they are sequential. And they correlate directly with the three pillars of power. The first is the ideological revolution. This is where we undermine the belief systems which support their control. This is where we systematically erode their illusion of legitimacy, their aura of power. We expose these criminals for the scoundrels that they are, and we inspire discontent among those who the state depends on for its functioning. If you're new to this, welcome to the party. It's already in full swing, and guess what? We're winning. The powers that be have lost control of the dialogue, and they know it.
In recent decades, worldwide social change has experienced unprecedented historical acceleration, particularly because instant mass communications, such as radio, television, and the internet, cumulatively have been stimulating a universal awakening of mass political consciousness. The resulting widespread rise in worldwide populist activism is proving inimical to external domination of the kind that prevailed in the age of colonialism and imperialism. Persistent and highly motivated populist resistance of politically awakened and historically resentful peoples to external control has proven to be increasingly difficult to suppress.
The second phase of the revolution is strategic noncompliance, or more accurately, defiance. This can take many forms, and multiple approaches can be used at the same time. The goal of strategic noncompliance is to interrupt the chain of obedience for as long as possible, as many times as possible, to publicize that interruption on as large of a scale as possible, to document the police and or military brutality that follows, and to distribute that footage far and wide. The purpose of this is to damage the ruling party's image, because power is all about image. It's all smoke and mirrors. Once that image starts to break down, this inspires others to disobey. Monkey see, monkey do. And when this catches on and contagion sets in, it becomes a force of nature, like a tidal wave. It's all about reaching critical mass. What's crucial to understand here is that revolutions are almost entirely psychological in nature. In this context, building confidence is the most important element. Therefore, it's better to do small, successful operations and build up from there than it is to start with large, high-stakes events. The third stage of the revolution comes when the people have built up the necessary momentum to take the monopoly on violence out of the hands of the current regime. In the best of circumstances, such a transition can be relatively peaceful. But this is only possible when a significant portion of the police and the military have taken the side of the people. The police and military are the enforcement arm of the state, and without them, the powers that be have no power at all. Faltering governments almost always resort to brutal repression to attempt to stay in power. But this is often a fatal error. Even one refusal to follow an immoral order can set off a chain reaction that destroys the illusion of authority that they so carefully cultivate. Once that happens, it's game over. In East Germany, on November 7, 1989, the Communist Party ordered the military to put a stop to mass protests which had been growing throughout that year. The commander of the army refused, and he ordered his men to stand down. This sent a clear message that the Communist Party was no longer in control. This realization spread quickly through the population, and communism fell. Now, since this is such a crucial element in the equation, it's not something that should be left up to chance. Every effort needs to be made right now to reach out to the police and military, to help them wake up to what's going on, and to let them know that the people will support them if they break the chain of command. Now that we've outlined the big picture, let's look at two other key elements, leadership and organizational structure. Our current system relies on a hierarchical chain of command, a social pyramid which allows a small handful of individuals to control everyone else. In sociology, this is referred to as vertical collectivism. If our long-term vision is not compatible with such a structure, it would be foolish to build a resistance movement which copies it. The ends don't justify the means. The means will determine the end result. So if we want a decentralized, non-hierarchical federation of autonomous communities to replace the current system, the movement must be decentralized and non-hierarchical as well. This doesn't mean that there's no place for leadership. To the contrary, leadership is essential. The distinction needs to be made between leaders and rulers. Leaders walk ahead of the crowd. Rulers place themselves above the crowd. What's needed is a vast network of leaders, independently motivated and capable of thinking for themselves, working to organize groups both locally in the real world and online, unified not by obedience to a single leader, but unified by an idea. Now, while this approach does present some challenges logistically, it has the advantage of making it virtually impossible to destroy the organization merely by getting rid of one or two leaders. A distributed organizational structure is much more resilient. So, where are these leaders? Well, don't wait for them to appear. We need you to be one of those leaders. If you don't know how to be a leader, learn. Dealing with crowds is a skill, one that you can refine through practice and study. Anyone who wants to learn the basic psychology of uprisings and how to work with the public should study the following books intensely, reading them several times, taking notes and reflecting on what they say. Three books, The Crowd and The Psychology of Revolution by Gustave Le Bon, and From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp. These books are all available online to read and download for free. You'll find links to these books in the description of this video. Now, a word of warning, these books contain politics, opinions, and prejudices that I do not endorse. Like all books, they should be read with a critical mind, questioning everything that's said. However, they do offer a great deal of insight as to how to take power out of the hands of a tyrant. Leadership takes many forms and can mean many things depending on the situation. However, the primary job of leaders is to inspire people to take action, to organize people into groups so they can be more effective than isolated individuals, and to train others to do the same. Now, the final element you need to start your revolution is tactics. In the realm of violence, the state has a definitive advantage, and it would be foolish to engage them where they are strongest. Instead, we should use tactics that engage them where they are weakest. Fortunately, there's no shortage of nonviolent tactics which have been proven effective in toppling dictatorships. Gene Sharp's book, From Dictatorship to Democracy, lists 198, but those are by no means the only ones that can be used. The tactics employed by each group will depend on the mission and the specific goals of the group. The military divides itself into Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine so that each can be specialized in the tactics of the terrain where they fight. Likewise, a nonviolent movement should have specialized groups for specific issues. This is already developing. We have PANDA, People Against the NDAA. PANDA is a national organization which has been working to fight the NDAA on the state and local level. And they've been having successes. What's most impressive is that the founder, Daniel Johnson, started this organization when he was 17. Also, there's the Oath Keepers, founded by Stuart Rhodes, which has been reaching out to the police and the military, reminding them of their oath, and preparing them psychologically to disobey when unconstitutional orders are handed down. The Oath Keepers have made a public stand against the NDAA, and they're gaining traction within the ranks. Others are organizing social media teams to collect and spread information. Others organize street activism, such as writing messages in chalk on sidewalks, or hanging up posters, or inserting small leaflets into books and magazines in the store. The possibilities are endless. Whether you start your own group, join an existing group, or act as an individual will depend on your disposition. No one can decide that for you. The most important thing is to take the first step. Start doing something. Anything. Take action and break the inertia of passivity. This is how you take back your power, 1 millimeter at a time. Now, right here, in this 15 minutes, you've been given enough information to start a revolution. You might need to watch this video more than once, and you will need to read those books. But now you have an instruction manual, something you can hand out to people and help them to learn. If you'd like more people to see this video, please share it through as many avenues as possible. Post it on Facebook, Twitter, on your blog, or send it to your friends via email. You have permission to download it, put it on disk, and distribute it on the streets. If you translate it, please post it as a video response so that it's easier for people to find. If you'd like more videos like this, subscribe to Storm Clouds Gathering on YouTube. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/StormCloudsGathering, on Twitter at Collapse Updates. You can find us on Google Plus by doing a search for Storm Clouds Gathering, and our website is StormCloudsGathering.com.